One of the ways I love starting episodes with you, Pam, is just sharing some of the things I've come across recently. Mm-hmm. Just ideas or things that are worth unpacking, maybe at a later date, but they're for sure worth sharing. And we don't necessarily fit this stage right now because our oldest is getting ready to leave for college at the time of this recording. So it's a new stage coming up, definitely.
Exciting new
Absolutely
stage.
Absolutely it
yes.
is. But I was listening to a guy that was talking about when your kids get married, that you're not welcoming a new person to your family. They are starting their own. Mm. As parents, you become extended family. And I think a lot of times we get that backwards.
That's
we think
an
that
intriguing...
you should continue mm-hmm. all of our traditions mm. rather than, no, you're starting your own. You're creating your own system, your own family, your own dynamic.
Which we think about so many of the people we talk about that they're... struggles with in-laws and the expectation of the parents to continue with traditions or things like that.
Right.
So that's a whole different perspective switch to help change that dynamic
right.
when your kids launch.
I love it. I love the idea of just thinking about that perspective and keeping it in mind that we want our kids to grow up and move on and be sufficient and living passionately as well.
We do. I want them to want me though. I want them to want to do my traditions and things because
well, they work
cause.
For us. They may not work for them. And that's part of what happens with marriage.
And
that's
likely
part of what
won't.
Happens with
yes.
family. And that's part of what we like to try to unpack and uncover is have the conversations that help couples not only help with their story, but with their entire family story, too. Because sometimes our framework matters. How we look at things matters.
I'd say all the time how we look at things
Fair
matters.
Enough. And that's kind of a nice segue into today's show, is I'm joined by a colleague, friend again, Dr. Jennifer Finlayson-Fife, is mm-hmm. back on with us again. I think this is the fourth episode with her.
Love having her on.
And she's a fellow Schnarchian, and we have a lot of the same viewpoint and framework, and so it's great to collaborate.
Okay, a lot of people, this might be their first time listening and they don't know what a Schnarchian is. So that's just the guy that really, Corey, patterns his
Most of my training
theory,
would be directly
training under,
from
so,
him.
So just a side point there yeah, for you.
Absolutely. Thanks for the little side point. But today we're talking and diving deep into the world of attraction and desire. And how, most importantly, the point we go with today's episode is, what do you do when it wanes? Why does it? Sometimes wane. Why does desire go away? Why does attraction sometimes go away? And what do we do about that? Because first off, I'll cut to the chase, it's normal. It can happen and will happen in a lot of marriages.
Ebb and flow.
And so it's important to recognize, what do I do about it? And because this topic is so pertinent, everybody gets the full episode today.
Ah, nice.
And so you're welcome to everybody.
So nice of you, Dr.
but,
Allen.
But it is one of those things that we want to have good conversations, and this is one that can help frame things for those that are listening.
I always appreciate the opportunities to catch up with my guest today, Dr. Jennifer Finlayson-Fife. I'm going to call you a friend, sure. not just a colleague now, because we've known each other quite a bit. I wanted to have a conversation because one of the things I keep coming across, and I know part of your work helped me frame this some too, is the whole concept of attraction and desire mm-hmm. of when you talk about just the iteration of a relationship and how it goes through the years, because mm-hmm. obviously I think most people would agree when it starts, it's easy.
Yeah.
if there's an attraction there, it's easy.
Yes.
If it's not an attraction, it's a quick lived relationship.
Yes.
But inevitably it seems like relationships hit that phase of, well, where did it all go?
Yeah.
What happened? Now I'm not attracted as like I used to be, or the desire has gone,
yes.
or things have shifted. And I just wanted to pick your brain sure. and have a dialogue about what's going on here.
Yeah.
You know, what's this whole thing going on, and how do we navigate it well?
Good. And maybe I'll work out some of my own thoughts as we talk about it.
Well, you and me both, girl.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because one of the things I got from you was, I believe it's Terry Riel's framework of the love without knowledge,
yes,
knowledge without love, that then spins into the ultimate goal of love with knowledge.
Knowledge, yes.
And so let's unpack that real quick, because some people might be unfamiliar with it.
Yeah, well, so Yeah, Terry Real talks about, I trained with Terry sort of in the beginning of my work, and I think he writes about it also in his book. I suddenly can't think of the name. I'll think of it in a second. But he talks about three phases of a relationship, right? As you talked about, love without knowledge, knowledge without love, and knowing love, or love with knowledge. So in the knowledge, in the love without knowledge is that phase of falling in love. And it's driven by, you know, just ton of dopamine floods the brain. It feels amazing. We feel this attraction and resonance and desire that is happening to us. And we're not really choosing it. In fact, sometimes it's very inconvenient, you know, because it just kind of comes out of nowhere and there it is and you feel it. And some people dismiss this phase, or they marry somebody that they don't ever have that with, which creates its own troubles, which we could talk about if we want to. But I think there's a strong biological component to this, at least according to, I heard John Gottman speak about this once, so I don't know specifically what research he was referencing, if it was his own or others, but about how there's a percentage of people that we will feel like a small percentage of people that we'll feel a visceral attraction to, and others that we will not. And I think, you know, there's something to do with like different pheromones and biology, and there, we tend to be attracted to people that our kids will have a stronger immune system, right? So there's some elements we tend to be attracted. If you look at wedding announcements, I think often people look like they could be siblings. So there's a familial element to it also, which I think is like the people you've loved tended to look like this prototype. So there is,
yeah. Don't we often go like goes after like, yeah, in a lot of ways, often. And you know, it makes sense to us in how they look, how they operate.
That's right.
Where
it's
they
intuitive,
live, et cetera, et cetera.
It's intuitive. Like I remember when I first met my husband, like I had this feeling like I would know how to love him, and it would, I don't know how to say that. Like that sounds sort of strange to say it like that, but it just felt intuitive. Mm-hmm. And like, and some people say, well, it means it's meant to be, or that it's divinely sanctioned or something. And I mean, I'm not here to say I know that's not true, but I think there's also a biological kind of resonance. I think we're also drawn to difference in this phase, which is, you know, the introvert tends to be drawn to the extrovert and vice versa. The person that's very spontaneous is often drawn to the more stable or predictable one. And I think that's valuable for having children, to have the sort of resources across capacities. It's also what in the knowledge without love phase becomes like the annoying things, the things that kill attraction. So it's often the very things in the beginning that drive it, that can kill it. And we can talk about that, because I would say there's a difference between this sort of attraction happening to you and a desire that's more choice-based, that's investment-based, that Dr. Schnarch talked about a lot. So I think making some distinction there. But the point, my larger point here is that desire happens to you, and it's in the beginning, and it's important. And when couples don't have it, it is harder. Like some people say, oh, that's just about sexuality, and therefore it's less than love. And I completely disagree with that, because attraction in marriage is important. But assuming that attraction is there in the beginning, that what often happens is reality of the limitations of the other person, the way they're different than you, the way they don't validate you at every turn like they did in the beginning, right? So just in the beginning, you're like, this person's looking at me like I'm the most amazing person, and I'm reflecting it right back to them. And so there's this mutual validation going on in the beginning, especially when there's not a lot of reality to deal with. But when you get married and you now have a mortgage, or you have kids, and you start having these issues of different realities, different desires, I want this, stop telling me what to do. This, how do we blend two lives in a meaningful way? And because that asks us to sacrifice aspects of ourselves to make room for another person, right? I think that process can be soul stretching. And if we are not careful, many of us go into marriage thinking, you owe me love. Okay, I'm locking in somebody who's going to love me like a parent, only better. And so they shouldn't want this thing. And the way they want to do Christmas is stupid, okay? And they've got the wrong idea. And so we start pounding on our partner to kind of be like us or reinforce us. Or we just start yielding to try to make the other person happy. but it starts to drive a meaning that kills attraction and kills desire. And so in the knowledge without love phase, that where you know a lot about your partner, but you're not sure you feel so much good feelings about them, this is where attraction tends to plummet. And because resentment kicks in. Why can't you be more like my dad, right? Why are you wanting this thing from me? It's the wrong thing to want. And that sense, so in the beginning, the your new partner has, it, like Dr. Schnarch would talk about, we want to belong to ourselves more than we want to have sex. And in that first phase, that person makes you feel bigger, better. They're connected to possibility. This person loves everything about me. So you feel attraction and connection. But when you get to know a lot about them, now it's like, well, okay, they want the house to be cleaner than I like, and they're so picky about it. And so it starts to be connected to a feeling of losing yourself. Now I need to do it their way, or they're always upset with me. Right. Or they want to have sex at a different pace that I want to have sex. And I feel, you know, that limits my happiness. And so because they start to be connected to a sense of constriction or loss of self, then often resentment kicks in and desire goes down. Now, that's not the only reason it can go down. There's another reason, but that's dominant, but that's a big reason.
Yeah, because I think what you're describing here is that natural evolution of a longer term relationship where, you know, I've always used the terminology of in a long term committed relationship, you can't hide as the time goes by. Right. You know, particularly if one or both of you are paying attention.
Right.
You can't hide who you are.
That's right.
That will be seen.
That's right.
And elements of you won't be liked.
Exactly. Even. And people who are inclined to have multiple affairs are basically looking for that first phase because that's all they can get. So that is, I want the easy validation of that initial attraction, that initial sexual experience, because they don't really know me. I don't know them. And if I'm someone who's willing to lie and cheat and so on, you know, anybody that really knows me is not going to be too validating of that. So people that are chronically looking for that shallow validation are wanting to stay in that first phase. But of course, while it's human and understandable on some level, because it feels so good, you never have the sense of being really known and desired, really someone who's invested in knowing who you are and having any peace in that reality. And so the natural evolution is in a sense the refiner's fire. That's like, okay, like I'm starting to expose who I am and who you are, and there's some ugly parts here and there's some incongruent parts here. And are we willing to be invested enough in a commitment to one another, to this marriage, to this sexual partnership, to work some of this out in an honest and fair way, a way that you can thrive and I can thrive? Most of us resist that process and pay a big price in terms of the quality of the marriage and the sexual relationship.
Yeah. And when you say there's also, this is something I just talked about in a recent episode that Pam and I did, that there's also a component of what's being challenged is my commitment to my marriage, but it's also what's being challenged is my commitment to myself.
Right.
Because it's going on simultaneously, right? That I have a dual relationship almost with self and other, right? You know, what we're creating together and what's being challenged of me, but how far, I mean, that's what Schnarch would always talk about, is I'll only go so far of giving up myself. And then I'll hit a point of like, no,
that's right.
I will stand up for me.
Yeah.
Right? I'll give for a while, but then that's what you're talking about, resentment, and some of that struggle can come in, because then eventually it'll be like, that's enough. I'm standing up. And sometimes it's an overreaction when I do so.
Exactly. So I do a podcast, a subscription podcast called Room for Two, and I'm working with couples doing coaching around the challenges that are in their relationship, around working out some of these questions around sexual intimacy and emotional intimacy. And the reason I call it Room for Two is, of course, the double entendre there, but the idea of how do we create room for two of us to thrive? Those are the happy marriages. according to all the good research, is that mm-hmm. people that feel like they can belong to themselves and expand their sense of self in a marriage are the happiest. People that feel like they have to close down important parts mm-hmm. of themselves. But of course, the important question is my standing up for this about me holding on to my dignity and something important in this marriage? Or am I just being selfish and bulldozing the other person? Which one is it, right? Like, and we don't often know, like, right. am I asking for too much right. or too little? Is the person's resistance because I'm just mm-hmm. unfair and I'm too, you know, too focused on my own demands? Or is the person resisting because they don't want to make room for the best in me? And, you know, I think part of the way we find the answers is how to, you know, it's like pushing, like, okay, am I giving too little? What really helps my partner to thrive? What is honest and good in the other person? And I need to respect it. One way we can kind of get closer to this mm-hmm. is what initially drew me to this person. Because a lot of times what drew us to the other okay. person were the very things that are different from us that then we want to squash when it's inconvenient for us, right? Like, mm-hmm. right? You know, like I was drawn to my husband's general kind of ease of being in the world, like just more laid back than me. I came from a family that was pretty driven and so on. My husband's very intelligent and thoughtful and reads a lot, but it was like his kind of a comfort in life and ability to be sort of thoughtful and talk through ideas with me that I was very, very drawn to. But that ease, like then I would sort of bring this demand that was kind of placed on me as a kid, like that you have to produce and do things. And then I would want him to be somebody who is producing and doing things because that was a reinforcement of a value that I liked and resented right. at the same time, right? You know what I mean? So it was like, don't do that mm-hmm. to him. That's never who he was. It's exactly the person I chose was somebody that wasn't like that. And I'm being ridiculous and unfair. Let him be who he is. So it was like me growing myself right. up a bit to let him be who he is and to not... and to value that quality, that's something that mattered to me. And anyway, that's just one version of it. But yeah.
Yeah. No, because I think that's part of the whole crucible, as Schnarch uses the term, of relationship, in the sense that what's being challenged is both members within that as well as the relationship.
That's right. Exactly. Right?
And that's a natural thing. And that's where I think the way we started this conversation is, it's not at all surprising to think that attraction and desire will wane as you get deeper and deeper into the fire, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And then you're faced with now shifting it the way I love your terminology of it's desire and attraction initially happens to us.
Yeah.
But then the ultimate goal is make it to where it's the choice that's from right. us, right?
That's right. And, you know, and that's what Terry Real talks about that too. That third phase is choice based. And, you know, we have to be differentiated enough to be capable of making a choice. A lot of times the way we get married is more out of a need for reinforcement, a desire for reinforcement of who we are. Come and prop me up and tell me I'm amazing. And I need you to tell me I'm okay mm-hmm. for me to feel okay. That's how most of us get married, but it has a short half-life and it starts to, you find quickly you can't get that reinforcement. Usually, if the marriage is healthy, you're going to find places you cannot get it. And that pressures mm-hmm. us to start to self-validate and to start looking more honestly at ourselves and to figure out where we feel that we're not being fair and decent and where we can stand behind our positions more strongly. But what happens then is you're more in a position to say, I choose this person who sometimes drives me crazy, who sometimes disappoints me, but I choose... really to bring my best to this person, to create a good sexual relationship with them, to value them, to create something that is compelling. I mean, that's really it. You're co-creating mm-hmm. a compelling relationship. You're co-creating meaning that makes your spouse desirable. My spouse is 64 years old now. I mean, maybe from an objective sensibility, he's not attractive, but from my point of view, he's very, very attractive. Because in part of the meaning yeah. of who this person is in my life, how he's, you know, the primary witness of my life, the person that has cared so much about me, the positive and expansive experience of a good sexual relationship, of course he's attractive, right? And it's not just based on mm-hmm. some physical ideal. It's based on a meaning that we have created together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the deeper thing, right? Because then you're moving it into this element of it's beyond something that's the superficial initial.
Yes.
Even though there's stuff, like you alluded to earlier, that there's still something that makes sense, which is usually the deeper.
Yes.
Right? It's that element of familial. It's that element of understandable or common experience. Yeah,
and the beauty
or
in it.
What have you.
The beauty right. in the other soul.
And then when you get deeper into mm-hmm. it, yeah, when you get deeper into it, then it's all of a sudden those deeper aspects of our being yes. and existence, which is impact, meaning, value.
What really matters in
things
life.
That really do drive us.
That's right.
Right. Things that separate us from just other things that happen right. in the world. That it's like, oh, I've seen that now. Okay, that makes more sense. And I think most of the time the people I come across that really struggle and wrestle with this are the ones that haven't seen it through that lens. They just think, it's attraction's gone. Right. It's over, broken.
Well, and you owe me validation. Wrong. And why haven't you given me the life that I wanted? Or why haven't you given me the sense of self that I wanted you to give me? And if you had been a good husband, you would have done X, Y, and Z. And, you know, just mm-hmm. the immaturity of that position. A lot of people hang on to that resentfully for life. And that's how they do marriage. And even if they stay married, that's how they do it. And, and they don't ever get to that phase of choice. And they aren't able to see the beauty that's there. Well, they don't create it. And so there isn't a lot of beauty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just my mom in this phase of being sick, all the meaning is so high. You know, we had family gather to be with her over this last weekend, and just so much beauty and good there. Like, that is so much appreciation and valuing and gratitude mm-hmm. and acknowledgement of her children, of her children-in-law, and just how precious life is and how precious love is. And mm-hmm. it requires a kind of ability to see what is good and what is beautiful. And if we're so caught up in our own egos and our own demands, we can't see it.
Yeah.
And a lot of us do marriage that way, and we really lose the good that can be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great way to frame it, because it's recognizing how often we see things only through our lens as it impacts and affects and goes according to my plan, rather than what about the fact that I'm part of a larger something? Mm-hmm. You know, because you got exactly. the human race. Yes,
exactly.
I owe some decency to others,
right.
but I also have my family. I have the people I've chosen to be in relationship with. I have neighbors. I have colleagues. You know, there's something I'm a part of a larger story, a larger something.
That's right. Exactly.
That when I can recognize and orient appropriately to that, that gives a different kind of energy
That's right.
and drive, hopefully.
That's right. Absolutely. So like in the New Testament, Christ says something, or I think it's, I'm trying to remember where it said, but basically we lose ourselves to find ourselves. And maybe it's the Sermon on the Mount. So you lose yourself to find yourself. Well, mm-hmm. a lot of people think that means you just like martyr, and then you just let people walk all over you, and mm-hmm. then you're going to find yourself in the next life, and you're going to get a big reward. But I don't think that's the meaning of it. You lose your ego. And by ego, I mean this kind mm-hmm. of demand about how people should see me, how people should feel about me, my preoccupation with how I'm understood or seen. And that's normal in the beginning part of our lives. It's a normal way to get married. But as Shanarsh talked about, marriage is a growth promoting machine. I can't remember how he used to say that. But, you know, that basically you can use the dyadic strains of marriage to grow yourself mm-hmm. up. I'm demanding too much. I demand mm-hmm. too much reinforcement. I'm not a very kind person. I really need to be more loving and caring for other people. I mean, marriage will show you that part of yourself, and or where you don't stand mm-hmm. up for yourself enough, right? Or where you don't hold on to your own mm-hmm. dignity enough. And it exposes our distortions. But ultimately, we grow out of that self-preoccupation to, as you say, Corey, be invested in the collective, in the marriage, in the family, in the group, not because you don't matter, mm-hmm. but you're letting go of that self-preoccupation. And that's where you find yourself. Like, that is, you feel whole, connected. Mm-hmm. You know you matter, as does everyone around you. You know that you are significant and the group is so important to your well-being, and you can hold on to both. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember Schnarr saying something like, anybody that screws with their support system screws with themselves, right? If you basically go looking for self-reinforcement at the expense of your marriage, at the expense of your family, you pay a massive price, even in your own sense of dignity and well-being, and you don't have friends if you mistreat the people around you. Mm-hmm. And so they're two sides of the same coin of like, how do I be fair to myself and the marriage? How do I be fair to myself and the group? And that's a fundamental tension, but one that drives us out of ego, but into wholeness and into meaning, and that drives mm-hmm. long-term desire. Like Schnarch's focus was desire in long-term relationships. How do you grow into somebody capable right. of desire? And not like, oh, I've got the hots for you, desire. No problem with having the hots for your partner. Okay. But like, I choose you. I value you. I cherish you in my life. I'm grateful to have you here next to me. You are a significant mm-hmm. friend and person that I care about, and I'm going to treat fairly and well to the best of my ability. That's desire. And it's driven by choice. And yeah. it's out of, when we're moving out of ego reinforcement demands into care, to actually loving out of choice. Mm-hmm.
So have you seen, I'm curious, this maybe this goes off the rails with this kind of a framework right now of where I'm trying to lead it in a sense, but have you seen both in the work you do and then also the fact that you're female, this impacts men and women differently on what it requires of them, what's challenged in them, what their route might be? Is there any variance in there?
Well, I think if I were to speak stereotypically, because it doesn't always fit the stereotype, but if I were to speak of women as a whole and men as a whole in traditional marriage, mm-hmm. because I work with a lot of traditional couples, because I work with Latter-day Saints a lot, I would say that women, so I have a women's course called The Art of Desire, which is about self and sexual development, and a men's course called Art of Loving, which is about self and sexual development and how to become someone more capable of intimate sexuality, right? So the reason why those mm-hmm. courses are named as they are is it's the vulnerability of each. So women are often sort of more intuitively and biologically wired to be self-sacrificing. I think this helps keep babies alive. Right. Yeah. Women are waking up in the middle of the night in part because I think they're more wired to track, right? They're tracking the minds of other mm-hmm. people more than men do. Men often think, hey, I don't even care what people think. It's partly because they're not even tracking what other people think. Okay. So I think men are often not as mm-hmm. tuned in, and women can be so tuned in that it can be handicapping, right? They can track everybody and feel kind of handicapped by what everybody thinks about them. The strength in that is the ability to attend to other people's needs and desires and be a caregiver, which is a big deal, significant right. to society, significant to the well-being of society, often undervalued unfairly, but highly, highly valuable work. The vulnerability for women often is their self in that dynamic, being able to hold a sense of their own desires. What matters to me? What is the self-development that is important for me to do? Not just what does everyone need from me? And so women's mm-hmm. development often goes initially into that sort of self-sacrificing, but as they grow, starting to make more room for themselves within their lives, within their group. Now, this is not all, sometimes this is men that do this and they're yeah. giving too much.
Absolutely.
Right?
I mean,
yes. Yeah. So there's always that.
We'll keep it stereotypical just for the sake of the conversation.
Exactly.
But yeah.
For men, often they're more, you know, if I want to sell courses online, I'll sometimes advertise. If I say to women, buy a gift for yourself this Mother's Day, no women click on it. You say to men, buy a gift for yourself for Father's right. Day, click, 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 click. Okay. If you say to women, yeah. you know, invest in your family and or invest in your sexual relationship, they'll do it because it's like, okay, I need to do that for my marriage. So, you know, so I kind of will right. appeal to people's strong suit, but to help them develop the other side. Yep. For men, it's the art of loving. How do you actually, maybe you like sex and maybe you don't have any anxieties about sex, right? Like maybe your partner does, but, or maybe you have fewer than you think. Okay. But you don't, that's not your vulnerability, but being invested, learning to love through sexuality, learning to invest in another partner, not the nice guy who's trying to just get get approval through sex, yep. Not that whole thing, but like actually invested in the well-being of your partner. How do you learn to sacrifice in a way that's solid and good for the collective? And for many mm-hmm. men, that's not as intuitive as the question of what do I desire? What do I want? What is my ambition? What am I going for? And so, again, that's a real strength, right? Society needs that kind of focus, that sense of mission, that sense of goal-oriented behavior, but it often can be at the sacrifice of relationships. And so how, as men grow, how do you right. develop this other capacity? Because women who love sex are with a partner that they know is invested in them. This is women's fantasies, is that man chooses me. Not because he likes sex with me. And he knows me and he cares about right. me. As Esther Perel says, the quickest way to a woman's vagina is through her head. I think something like that. That is to say, to know her, to know what she matters right. to her. And so, you know, that learning how to not just care if you're going to get sexual reinforcement, but care about the woman herself. So that's often the different pathways that people grow and develop. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a lot of overlap.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because I think what you're pointing out is there can be a gender-based strength and weakness that's going right. on. And what's being exposed that's right. in the relationship is the weakness.
That's right. Exactly right.
Because you something you alluded to and stated earlier is, you know, our spouse's job, we don't think of it this way, but a lot of times our spouse will inherently expose the aspects of us that are underdeveloped right. or are anxiety ridden exactly. or, you know, whatever it might be. And then when they take a break, I like to use the phrase, when our spouse takes a break, our kids step in mm-hmm. and okay. expose more.
That's right.
Or pick up the baton yep. and keep going. Yep. Because one of the things I've noticed with our oldest girl just graduated high yep. school, so she heads off as we're recording this in about a month to college, yeah. a couple states away.
Yep.
And so I'm noticing Pam, it's not clingy, but she's upped the I want to capture every moment sure. possible quotient
yes.
with her. Whereas I've noticed what I battle is not pushing away.
Yeah.
right. Because it's kind of like, I see the pain coming. So I'm going to avoid because that's right. what gets exposed exactly. in me is a natural tendency of, I don't want to deal with the hard and the grief and the loss that is coming.
Yep.
So exactly. I'll just push it away
yeah.
and avoid. And I think that's a natural aspect at play here.
Yes.
Of, that's the dynamic of a relationship is right. it's challenging ourselves when all too often, if I'm not at my best,
right.
I blame my partner for even exposing
exactly.
that. Well, I blame them for bringing that up or wanting whatever it is or right. reacting the way they're reacting rather than, no, that's just a natural thing.
Exactly. And couples often do, they work out a dynamic between them without recognizing they're taking up two sides of the same tension. So that is to say, like, let's say that Pam were avoidant. Well, you might get more moving in towards your daughter. Let's go do this together. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, you kind of balance out the need.
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally.
And then you look totally. At the other person and say, what's wrong with you? And this is very typical. Like, one will be the heavy with the kid. One will be the merciful one. And the more that each entrenched, yep. the more they sort of justify the other rather than, look, we're kind of playing out our ambivalence, our shared collective ambivalence. And maybe we can forgive each other a little more mm-hmm. and forgive ourselves a little more for having this ambivalence or uncertainty so that you don't vilify the other
yeah,
person.
Yeah, because I think that's there. Mm-hmm. Right, because there's such a systemic thing going on,
right?
Because as we're talking through this, I'm even thinking what's happened is our youngest, who's 16, he's upped the edgy, grumpy, yes. reactive, curt
yes.
mentality, which that's a factor in this thing too, because he's playing off like he's not going to miss her, but they're best friends.
Yeah.
Right. They've loved being with each other. They do a lot together. And it's just this whole, like, as I'm sitting here thinking through this, looking at it from a different lens now, that's a natural thing. So how do we lean into that is basically our opportunity for all of us to grow.
That's right.
Or for sure, at least me.
Yes. And just appreciate it for what it is, you know, that like, and forgive ourselves. That's the best antidote, because it actually softens it rather than get, why are you being so edgy and mean, you know, knock it off. Yeah. What,
right.
Rather, you know, again, like just going through this difficult period right. with my mom, I can see like my lesser self emerge in times when I'm not expecting it and, or seeing it in others. And the more like slack you can cut everybody, just like, it's just not easy. And the more we can just forgive ourselves and each other, the better this is going to go. And really, it's like a big, heavy hit of compassion when life is about giving us grief and loss and even intimacy and our ambivalence about intimacy and closeness. We can do all these things. So yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I had another thought. As
Because I think it's important.
Go ahead.
Oh, if it comes to you, interrupt me. But I think it's important that the words you just mentioned of compassion, that's one of those things that I think that's, if I look at, it's not necessarily a hierarchy, but maybe that's the best way to think of it. That's higher up there, because that's almost a choice that I'm granting. You know, it's like, it's something I have to like orient towards. Yes. It's not just necessarily natural.
That's right. Well, that's how I think of, you know, I think of ego as the enemy to joy. And I think of compassion as the friend to joy. And so if you think about like what I think of as the best in Christian theology is the idea that compassion and love leads us into beauty and freedom, leads us into joy. And so compassion is not natural. Now, attachment is natural. You know, desire to be close to others is natural. It's just born, is inbred. Okay. But that's very different than compassion and love, which is to truly be capable of forgiving ourselves for our human condition, to forgive another person for their difficulty, their challenges in love, their self preoccupation, and to forgive ourselves. And I don't mean like, oh, whatever, it doesn't matter kind of compassion, not flippancy.
No, not at all.
Flippancy, but just mercy, just kindness that like, look, these things are, life is not easy. We do lesser things, myself included. And can I bring a good dose of forgiveness to this project? And we keep trying and keep striving to love better, to care about others, and to forgive ourselves as well. Because I think that is that is what drives togetherness, is that merciful connection with one another. And so I think love leads the way into truth, into truthful living, into truthful relationship, into the capacity for intimacy, the capacity to really invest in another person and care about them. But it pushes us to be better people, pushes us to be stronger, to be capable of it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Which then leads us into how we started this whole conversation of that's how, in a lot of ways, you can then make it a chosen desire,
that's right.
a chosen,
yes.
You know, I embody it
exactly.
Better. Rather than it's something that's just coming to me.
I was speaking to my brother recently and about, you know, he's bringing up marriage and differences between men and women or something like that. And I said, you know, when you really think about it, like marriage is a big ask. I mean, in this, like, you know, I know I and girlfriends would think like, oh, when we get married someday, we're going to be like sitting on the swings, holding hands, like these really over the top romantic ideals that are completely unrealistic. You know, I was watching Jane Austen film recently and they're great, but they really are porn for women. Okay. Like that is unrealistic portrayals of male proposals. And, and my brother was saying, yeah, those things are terrible. Mm-hmm. Make us have no chance. Right. What a lot of women say about pornography for men is like, these are unrealistic portrayals and so on. But you know, what often we want reinforcement around as women and what men often want reinforcement are really not going to be readily offered to us in marriage. And so we're kind of coming in with these colliding, self-reinforcing anticipations. And then marriage shows up in and gives us a good shake and a good dose of reality. And then it comes right down to, am I going to choose this suffering, or am I going to resent it and resist it? Am I going to lean in? You know, when I often think about this, when I'm exercising and I'm thinking about 10 more minutes will be over, it just gets worse. If I'm like, lean in and embrace the difficulty, mm-hmm. it gets easier. And it's similar with marriage, like lean in and embrace the hard, embrace the challenge of this and grow from it. Use it. Use the suffering to become a better human, right. a better, more loving person. Let it teach me about myself. Let it be teach me about what is true, and learn to build a bridge across these differing worlds and grow into a greater sense of oneness in purpose. That's not just about ego reinforcement, but about who we can be as two different people and how we can truly grow to be people capable of friendship. And it's beautiful because it's a sexual friendship as well, or it can be if we choose it. And so that's like the good stuff. That's where all the mm-hmm. rich desire is. And it's desire based in strength, not just ego reinforcement.
Yeah. No, that is so good. So Jennifer, how can people find you? Obviously, I promote your stuff. I talk about you because you have really, really good stuff. Thank but you. What's the best way for those that are just now hearing you first to find you?
Well, probably the best way. So if you've never heard me before and you want to just know more of the way I think, you can go just listen to a free podcast I do, which is Conversations Like This. And it's called, first of all, go to my website, which is finlayson-fife.com. And under the podcast tabs, there is just Conversations with Dr. Jennifer. And there are conversations like this in which I'm talking about aspects of faith, relationships, sexuality, intimacy, desire, differences, all those good things. On there also, I have my Room for Two podcast where I'm working with couples. Now, I do a lot of work with LDS couples, but it's the way I sound today, which is I'm talking about Christian themes and sometimes, but mm-hmm. primarily mm-hmm. these human differences and how we grow into people capable of love and desire. So I have that Room for Two podcast you can subscribe to and listen to me working with real couples who have pseudonyms and distorted voices, but nonetheless real couples. In how to apply a lot of the principles I teach to the real day-to-day life of marriage. And then I also have 5 online courses around how to either talk to your kids about sex and help them develop sexual integrity, which I explain there what that is, but then also how to grow into a emotionally intimate and sexually intimate marriage. Those are all courses based to facilitate that goal. Yeah.
Yeah. And I recommend them highly because it's you frame things really, really well and your perspective, and it's practical in the sense that the thing I love, just, you know, having been trained with Schnars too, is it's not a formula. It's just a way to look at things and then do it better.
Exactly right.
Right. It's not a plus B will equal C.
That's right.
Right. Instead, it's
absolutely
look at this through a different lens, and that's then exactly. we get a better power.
I say that to people all the time, like at the beginning of the workshops, is just, you know, this is about shifting. It's not a lack of trying. You've been trying to address your marriage or your lack of desire or the challenges in your sexual relationship. So it's not about a lack of trying. It's that you maybe are likely trying from a paradigm, from a meaning frame that will not allow you to change or address the problem. And I want to give you a different way to look at the same issues that opens up all kinds of possibilities. So I'm kind of taking down the old inherited meaning and giving people a new way to think about what's happening and what they can do. And it's helpful for people because they are suddenly like, okay, now I know what I can do. Now I get what the problem is and what my role is in addressing it. And that can be a huge relief. And they start to also see meaningful shifts happening in themselves and in their marriage. And it's a big deal. So it's satisfying to facilitate that.
Well, Jennifer, I appreciate so much the opportunity to connect with you again and look forward to more in the future.
Great. Thank you, Corey.
It's so helpful to me to just get reminders of the fact that there are just natural, normal dynamics that happen in marriage. And a lot of the things that we have that happen that aren't necessarily what we would deem as good, we would maybe label it as broken, actually can be normal. Mm. It's a natural thing that what drew us together will drive us crazy.
High desire, low desire, low desire. I felt like I was broken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wasn't.
And it's also a natural thing to recognize that just away from this conversation that when it went was with Terry Real's work of knowledge, love without knowledge, knowledge without love, and then knowing love are the stages we're trying to grow through. Because as you get to know each other, you see parts of each other. It's like, I don't know if that's as attractive as I thought it would be. That's a normal thing.
Yeah.
And so it's important, I think, to recognize the hope would be, I can grow through this and we can taste something we've never even tasted yet. Mm-hmm. To me, that's so exhilarating to think about for a long-term relationship. Mm-hmm.